This is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. Today we have some really interesting guests with us. Our first guest is Eva Holland, and she's the author of the great new timely book, Nerve. And then our second guest is Brent Gortson, and we're going to be talking about emotion and the stages of grief. But here's Alan with the Health First News first.
The number of prescriptions filled for anti-anxiety drugs spiked 34%, and orders for anti-anxiety and anti-insomnia medications also increased from mid-February to mid-March and peaked around March 15th, according to a new report released April 16th. According to the report by Express Scripts, a pharmacy benefit manager owned by Cigna, the increase demonstrates the serious impact COVID-19 may be having on our nation's mental health. The data is based on Express Scripts customers with employer-funded insurance. Anti-anxiety medications had the largest jump, with the number of filled prescriptions increasing 34% from February 16th to March 15th. Antidepressants increased about 19%, and anti-insomnia orders increased nearly 15%. Frequent hand washing with soap and water is key to preventing the spread of coronavirus, but what's the best way to dry your hands afterward? In a new, small study, British researchers found paper towels were better than the air dryers often found in public restrooms at getting rid of germs that are still in your hands after you wash them. Study author Innes Moura, a research fellow at the University of Leeds, said good hand-washing practice should be followed by proper hand-drying. Paper towels can help reduce the spread of microbes and should be a preferred method of hand-drying, especially at a time when good hand hygiene is the most effective measure to prevent COVID-19. The method used to dry hands can help reduce microbial contamination, not just on hands, but also on the body and the environment outside the washroom, she explained. The findings were scheduled to be presented at the now-cancelled meeting of the European Society of Clinical Microbiology and Infectious Diseases. With allergy season and the coronavirus pandemic overlapping this spring, one allergist offers some advice on how to tell which one may be making you miserable. Dr. Rachna Shah, an allergist at Loyola Medicine in Maywood, Illinois, says this spring allergy season has been especially challenging because of the pandemic of COVID-19, and a lot of my patients and a lot of allergy sufferers can have a hard time distinguishing between what is an allergy and what are symptoms of COVID-19. Shaw said typical symptoms of seasonal allergies include itchy eyes, itchy nose, sneezing, runny nose, and post-nasal drip. Symptoms of COVID-19 include fever, cough, shortness of breath, fatigue, muscle aches, diarrhea, and sometimes a sore throat. Shaw added the big differentiating factor between allergies and COVID-19 are those itchy symptoms, itchy eyes, itchy nose, and sneezing.
Thanks, Alan, for the Health First News. We have Eva with us today, Eva Holland, and she's the author and she's also a freelance writer living up in the Yukon. Her book that has just come out this month is called Nerve, and it's a personal journey through the science of fear. Welcome, Eva.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's so good to have you here. And what a timely book. If there was ever a better time to really look at the science of fear, I think it's right here, right now. So we're so glad to have you with us. How do we feel fear? What did you learn about fear when you started this journey?
I was really interested to learn how it actually works. You know, we all experience it, but we don't necessarily think about the mechanism behind it. And what I learned is that actually it sort of inverts what I would have expected. Your expectation might be that you sense a threat and you feel afraid, and then your body catches up to the emotion, you know, with things like accelerated heart rate, maybe goosebumps, you know, your pupils dilate, this sort of thing, all these physical reactions that we call our fight or flight response sometimes that we experience when we feel afraid. But actually, scientists believe that the physical response comes first, that our brain senses the incoming threat, let's say, you know, a strange noise heard in the night, and triggers the physical response, so your chest tightens, your breathing and heart rate accelerates, all this stuff, and then your brain says, oh, my body is having a fear reaction, and that's when the emotion is triggered, which surprised me at first, but then if you think about it, it makes a kind of sense in terms of how we feel these things, right? It's a very physical reaction.
Mm-hmm. So it's our body that feels it, and then our brain. How does our body feel the fear?
We have sensors, not just for what we talk about in terms of smell, taste, touch, this sort of thing, but also pressure, heat, and so our body senses an incoming threat or a potential threat, something out of place, maybe like a strange noise, and then relays that information to the central nervous system and the brain, and that's where a brain structure called the amygdala basically makes the assessment of, is this a threat or not? And if yes, it triggers our autonomic nervous system, or what we sometimes casually call our fight or flight response.
Mm-hmm. Eva, how did you come upon needing to learn all this? Can you tell us how your story started?
Absolutely. So several things happened in a row that sent me down the path of researching and writing this book. My mom died suddenly from a stroke in the summer of 2015. And I had always been very afraid of my mom dying, maybe in a more kind of acute way than the average kid. No kid, you know, likes the idea of their parents dying. But my mom had lost both her parents when she was really young. And so I had grown up very aware of the devastating impact of those losses on her, and very afraid of the same thing happening to me. And so when she did die, it was sort of my worst fear coming true. Mm-hmm. But a few months later, after sort of the worst of the grief had passed, I realized I was very sad, but I wasn't going to be harmed in the same lasting ways that she had been. I was an adult. She'd been a child. It's not the 1960s anymore. We have sort of better understandings of how to help people process the loss of a parent, that sort of thing. So I understood that I was going to be okay. And that was empowering, realizing that I had essentially faced my worst fear and survived. And I had been wrestling with some other fears in recent years, specifically a pretty serious fear of heights, and then some traumatic memories from a series of car accidents. And so coming through the worst of my grief after my mom's death made me think, well, maybe I can face these other fears and change how I relate to them, you know, cure, overcome them, the language that we tend to use.
So this really got you on the journey of personal work, feeling all these feelings, and especially fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought maybe I can change this relationship. Maybe I can renegotiate the dynamics between me and my fear. And then it seemed logical to write about that if I was going to be kind of going on this journey myself.
And how do you differentiate like phobias, fear, anxiety? How do you line those up?
Mm-hmm. It's a complicated question. They're all very closely related. And so there's an extent to which I try to sort of parse the differences in the book, but also show the connections. People typically talk about fear versus anxiety as being the difference between whether the threat is sort of objective or subjective. So people might say there's a clear and present threat. You know, there's a bear in your campsite. That's mm-hmm. a clear and present threat. That's fear. And anxiety is lying awake in your tent when there is no bear, worrying about the possibility of a bear would be the way people would sort of tend to delineate the two.
Uh-huh.
But it's tricky to find a clear line between them. You know, the threat is really sort of only in your head if you're not even in bear country and you're worrying about the bear. But if you are in bear country and there could be a bear, then is the fear rational or irrational, subjective or objective? It gets a little messier to tell. So it was interesting to me to learn the extent to which trauma and phobias and anxiety disorders are all really sort of members of a family.
Okay. And then phobias are if there is no bear and you're in downtown Vancouver.
Right.
Right. Or, you're still afraid of bears. Yeah.
Phobias are fearing, an ancient Greek called them fearing that which need not be feared.
Okay. Yeah. That makes good sense. Now, in your book, you talk about having a fear of heights and like some sort of connection that you weren't free to dance. How does that come up that those are connected?
So I should preface this by saying it's only, you know, one study that I came across that really mm-hmm. fascinated me. But I did find a German study that suggested that a number of people who are afraid of heights, it's because of an over-reliance on visual cues when we move through the world. So we all, back to those bodily sensors again, we all have sort of a way of understanding our movement through space as people, right? And it's not purely that we can see where we're putting our feet because we can walk without looking at our feet, that sort of thing. But mm-hmm. But there's some evidence to suggest that people with a fear of heights are overly dependent on our visual senses to control our movement through space. And so then when we are at heights, if we're up a ladder or on the edge of a cliff, you know, it distorts our understanding of our place in space, and we become afraid because feel like we might fall. And that study really spoke to my experience. My fear of heights was really only triggered when I felt like I could trip and fall and not, you know, in an airplane, for instance, or an elevator. And so the suggestion was that maybe, you know, if we sort of have lesser understanding of our body's movement through space, then that might be why we're, you know, not comfortable dancing. Mm-hmm. And that I've always been a total wallflower when it comes to dancing, certainly in front of anybody else. So that spoke to me. You know, obviously it's only one study, but I like the idea that maybe there's a medical reason why I don't like to dance.
Okay, so I know that you've been skydiving. Did that make you a better dancer?
Going skydiving did not make me a better dancer. Okay. It did not cure my fear of heights either.
And when you chose to go skydiving, was it the fear of heights you were trying to overcome, or just the whole grief pattern from your mother passing? Or do you know what you were trying to correct with that skydiving experience?
Yeah, I had the idea early on that maybe if my fear of heights is as much as anything else, a fear of falling, maybe I could sort of pop it like a bubble if I did a free fall from 10,000 feet.
Right.
It did not work that way. It turns out that exposure therapies involve something much more gradual and sort of kinder to yourself than just doing the worst thing you can think of. Unfortunately, the skydiving company, they were so hopeful that I would just fall in love with it. And I made it through, but I would not say that that I was changed by it in any positive way.
So it was a one-time experience.
Yeah, that was a one-time thing for me, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So looking back at that and looking at trying to get over difficulties with high places, have you worked at a more gradual pace to alleviate that from your life?
Yeah. After the skydive, I used a workbook to create a more traditional exposure therapy type of regimen, using rock climbing, very sort of basic beginner rock climbing as the framework to try to slowly build up a better tolerance for heights. And that was I spent a summer trying, and the thing that I hadn't understood previously when I had tried to do these things to cure my fear of heights is that it's not about breaking through the fear and coming out the other side. It's about building a new channel or pattern in your brain so that you don't become afraid in the first place. So it's not about gritting your teeth. It's about learning to remain calm in the first place and building sort of a new brain structure that doesn't have that pathway to panic.
Creating a new relationship with fear.
Yeah, and so the idea was that I should only climb as high as I could without getting upset, where previously I would have pushed and pushed and pushed until I was upset. Mm-hmm. The trick to this exposure therapy effort was to try to only stop just before I started to get upset and come back down and try to get even one step further next time. It's a very gradual process.
Okay, and fear, now it's something you can even smell. Is that true? You can really smell fear? Is that how you know when it's starting?
It's not our own fear that we smell. It's the fear of others. And that was only really recently determined. We've understood for a long time that other animals, prey animals, can sort of smell fear in our terminology on each other. It's not exactly our olfactory senses, but it is...
Okay.
It's airborne pheromones, fear pheromones, they're called alarm pheromones. And we knew that prey animals had them, and it was only fairly recently determined, actually using skydiving for the research, that humans can smell fear on one another. And so it's a silent alarm system that we can use to say there's a predator, there's a threat, and it's these pheromones we give off that sort of drift through the air to each other. And we would describe that as smelling fear.
Okay. Eva, we're going to go to a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about fear.